5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Happy Wednesday, Croc Nation. This is your survivorship bus driver, Tommy and Ellie, along with Angel Santana, best co-host, podcaster of all time. Angel, did you miss me last week?
I was going to say, it's so good to see that smiling face.
I have to tell my Croc constituents, my dear Croc family, my Croc Nation, that last week, although I did miss you all, I really did need that week of sitting on the Jersey Shore. And I meant to say, I think the Jersey Shore has a very, very misunderstood or the reputation is a little bit like, hey, how you doing? And the Jersey Shore is not, hey, how you doing? The Jersey Shore, let me tell you, I am a Jersey guy. I live in New York now. I will always be a Jersey guy. The Jersey Shore is where all Jersey people go to get ideas, to relax, to decompress. Thank you for doing our podcast last week with the waiting room. Much appreciated. But I did want to say to the Croc Nation that while I was sitting on that beautiful New Jersey beach with that expanse of sand and looking at the beautiful water and the dolphins and trying to catch some fish and just having a great time with my wife, trying to reconnect, we're sitting there looking at the water. And I'm always thinking, you know, how we could, improve our podcasts, new ideas for podcasts. And I was thinking, we really don't have a patient empowerment module. So why don't we start a patient empowerment module? And of course, our friend, Dr. Dawn Stacey, nurse professor extraordinaire, author of hundreds of articles, one of the most progressive nurse researchers in the country, one of the most impactful people I have ever met, had reached out to us to talk about discussing some symptom management tools. She introduced us to Claire Ludwig. And I'd like to tell you about these two women who will be our guests this week. And this week is going to be a little bit different, Angel. We're going to do a two-part podcast. So the podcast that we're about to tape is actually going to be two podcasts. What do you think about that?
I'm ready and I'm excited. Let's go. Let's go.
So
let's
it's
go.
It's like a twofer. So Dr. Dawn Stacey, as I said, holds a research chair in knowledge translation to patients and is a professor in the School of Nursing at the University of Ottawa. She is a senior scientist and scientific director of the Patient Decision Aids Research Group at the Ottawa Hospital Research Institute. She leads the Cochrane Review of Patient Decision Aids, co-chairs of the Steering Committee for the International Patient Decision Aid Standards Collaboration, and collaborates on that Cochrane Review. More specifically, her research program focuses on patient decision aids, decision coaching, implementation of evidence into practice, telephone-based care, and interprofessional approaches to shared decision-making. She has over 275 peer-reviewed publications and has given over 160 invited national and international presentations. In 2020, she won the Nursing Research Excellence Award from the Canadian Association of Schools of Nursing and the University of Ottawa Award for Excellence in Research. A true gem of a professional, well-deserving of all of her accolades, and we are more than pleased, as a matter of fact, much privileged to have Dr. Dawn Stacey on today. Claire Ludwig, we just got to know today. What a dynamic, we called her, Angel, a superhero. A courageous woman. She's a PhD candidate at the School of Nursing at the University of Ottawa. Her doctoral work is focused on patient engagement and research, specifically engaging frail and seriously ill patients as knowledge users. Her other research interests examine how patients and nurses negotiate the process of triage and self-management in cancer symptom management. Claire is a healthcare executive, presently Vice President of Home and Community Care at the Champlain LHIN. She is also a patient with cancer. My Croc Nation, when you hear Claire's story, it will actually raise the hairs on the back of your neck. This woman is a true, true hero. And Angel and I are so privileged and honored and grateful to have both of these women on our podcast today. I would like you guys to hold on 1 second. We're going to take a brief break. And when we come back, Dr. Dawn Stacey and soon to be Dr. Claire Ludwig.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back, Croc Nation. As promised, Angel Santana to my left. Tom Iannelli here, front and center, with two heavy-hitting research foundational pioneers. We have Claire Ludwig and we have Dr. Dawn Stacey. Welcome, ladies.
We're pleased to be here.
We are pleased as punch to have you. We are very honored, actually, to have you. This is very exciting to us because, as we discussed off air, we are actually starting a separate module for your life's work. This module is going to be a patient empowerment module. And the subject matter, it's going to be a two-part podcast. And it's going to be entitled Patients as Partners in Research. And I think it's really, if you think about it, it's so simple and sounds like it makes so much sense, but how long have we basically ignored the patient, even though it's really the patient that drives the ship? Dawn, let's start there with starting to put the patient first, which is really a brand new situation.
So thank you, Tom, for having me back on the podcast. So I'm an oncology nurse and a professor in the School of Nursing, where I really do a lot of research focused on how can we better support patients with decisions that they have to make. And so the decision that we're going to be focused on today is really around when they're experiencing side effects and symptoms related to their cancer treatments, and what is sort of the best ways in which they can be supported to be making decisions around whether or not they need to come in more urgently or whether or not they can manage some of these symptoms at home.
And as we discussed, your life's work, some of the, you've done so much, Dawn, and we are so grateful for all your work on behalf of our patients. But one of the things that I think stands out to me is your work with what's called the CoSTAR model. Perhaps you can tell us, exactly what that is and how it came to be.
The CoSTARS is the Pan-Canadian Oncology Symptom Triage and Remote Support Project. So it's got a big long name, but it's known as CoSTARS. And what we did in around 2007, we started working on this project to try and figure out how can we better support nurses who are on the telephone from experiencing different symptoms. And so we looked around at that time to see what existed. And what we found is that any of the guidance documents were based on opinions of the people at the table that developed any kind of guidance document. And so we decided that we should apply a researcher approach to this and look at what do the practice guidelines say around what's the best practice for managing nausea or for managing diarrhea or fatigue. And so we actually there's also many, many different practice guidelines across countries. And so we actually searched to identify all of the practice guidelines for each of the symptoms. And so for nausea, for example, I think we have around 10 or 12 practice guidelines from around the world that are published in English. And we then created a 2-page guidance document on what are the key things that we need to ask the person that has the symptom. What are the medications that we need to review because they're the common medications used for helping manage that symptom? And then what are some of the things that can be done at home easily to try and ease the symptom? Because a real issue is we want to make sure that the person with the symptoms is safe at home and that if they do need to get in more urgently, that we can actually also help them understand why there's urgency around coming in right away or having a follow-up call from a physician.
Well said, and just to kind of break it apart, as I always do, let's talk first of all about symptoms. So one of the reasons why we have this podcast, one of the reasons why advocacy for cancer survivors is so important, and this goes back to the beginning you know, of survivorship and our defining survivorship module, going back to, you know, to the days in the 60s and 70s and 80s. I think in those days, the general model was, hey, we're curing you of your cancer, perhaps. If you have some symptoms, you know what, deal with it because you're alive. And I think that was basically the thought process from the care, from the caregiver. And especially in cancer, again, as advocates for cancer survivors, that's not good enough. We can do better with symptoms. And I wanted to hear you kind of speak to that. And also Claire, as a survivor, God bless you. You know, your position with that, just being a survivor with symptoms and how the healthcare professionals do that. Yep.
Thank you, Tom. And I would just, I'd like to just maybe challenge you a little bit and say that unfortunately the attitude exists that, yeah, you're having treatments, you've got cancer, you've got, you know, significant tumor burden or whatever. You can expect this, you can expect to have symptoms. And so I'm not sure how far we've shifted necessarily from the 70s and 80s to present day. I think we're doing better, but I would have to say my own experience, you know, it was expected that I would have a certain amount of symptoms and just bear those.
You know, I Claire, that was beautiful. And I agree with that. But you know where I think I see a difference? Having been able to span a career from the 80s to now, is that the difference is, and I'm not disagreeing with you at all, and I welcome the challenge and I accept it and I agree with your words. I think that we're more willing to be open to try to get our patients a better quality of life in addition to their cure. But I think there's a practitioner impotence in the sense that we don't know yet how to ameliorate your symptoms adequately. And this is a really good segue to Dawn, because I'll tell you, when I looked at her training video on the website, which we will give everybody to make sure they get to that website and see all the things we're talking about. But in that scenario, I see myself every day, multiple times a day, going into rooms with patients with complaints. And as Dawn and I and you were talking about before, the compartmentalization of responsibility. So if I'm irradiating a breast and you have a headache, that's not my problem, right? Because I'm not irradiating your head. Or if I'm irradiating your breast and you have diarrhea, you know, we send you back to the medical oncologist to deal with something else. So I think that, and also not having great answers to your problems. One of the biggest problems is patient-related, treatment-related fatigue. You tell a doctor, I'm tired, they're going to say, well, yeah, we're giving you chemotherapy, we're giving you, of course you're tired, but there's not like, okay, here's what we're going to do. There's the 12 steps that we're going to take. We're going to, number one, increase your sleep. Number two, address your diet. Number three is we're going to do a 20-minute exercise program. Number four is we're going to put you on a meditation program. Like, we don't do that. We're just like, yeah, you're tired because you're getting cancer treatment. So Dawn, walk me through that video. It was outstanding and really is to Claire's point about what needs to be done, what's not being done, even though we know it should be, it's not being done.
So in the video, we demonstrate a better approach to looking at symptom management. And this is really based on a number of tape recordings that we've done between nurses and patients that are calling about symptom management. And one of the things that we find is that the often the nurse just takes the immediate what the patient's asking and says, okay, how bad is it? Okay, let me look into it, as opposed to actually really assessing to determine how bad is the symptom. And so with nausea, for example, which is the example in that video, it's really looking at how much is it impacting on what they're eating? What kinds of things are they eating? Because we know that some foods can make you feel more nauseated than others. It's also looking at, are they getting enough fluids and hydration? And are they, the other key one is around, do they have medications to help control the nausea? And how well are they being able to take them or follow them? Or are they afraid to take them because they don't really want to have to take more medication. And so in the co-stars, it really helps guide through what are the key questions that need to be asked in an assessment to try and really understand better how bad is the symptom, and is it really severe, or we need to call an ambulance for someone who's got really severe symptoms? Is it more moderate, where we need to give them some guidance and follow up in 24 hours? Or is it more on the mild side, where they can probably manage all right on their own, and if it gets worse, they could call back?
I wanted to take a deep dive into that video because I was very impressed by it. So as we mentioned, and I'm going to get Claire's take from being actually on that chair, right? So she's the one who's, you know, experiencing this interaction. Number one, you point out to your nurses how important it is for them to be at the level of the patient, to look at the patient in the eye. And one of the biggest criticisms I hear from patients all the time, hopefully not about me, but I'm not immune to having perfect days either, having a bad day as well. Doctors and caregivers looking at computers instead of looking at their patients. Let's start right there. Claire, your thoughts, if you have a practitioner who's looking at a monitor and not looking at you.
Yeah, I think that it's so dismissive. And I think there's so much opportunity when you're looking in somebody's eyes, when you're seeing how tired they are or how difficult they are, the difficulties that they're having with finding words, or just the waves of nausea that you can see washing over somebody. And I think sometimes perhaps healthcare professionals, whether it's nurses, whether it's doctors, don't always take the time to really see the person in front of them. And there's so many nonverbal cues that they can pick up on. And I will go further than that. Like, that's about seeing somebody for who they are, for the person that they are, not just the patient that they are in front of you.
And then you mentioned, Claire, the word time, and you mentioned it as far as, you know, time to look at your patient and pick up those verbal cues. But let's talk about time, because I had written that as another thing. In Dawn's training video, the nurse took a lot of time, because if you think about it, and the way I look at life is, you know, life is like a puzzle, and each problem or obstacle that comes up to us almost requires a very analytical approach, an approach where everything just melts away. You know, the telephone calls and the cell phone and the texts and the nurses grabbing you to do this or that, or the therapist telling you that you have to go to the CT sim or go to the table. And you really have to kind of let that go and basically be there and MacGyver the situation, because in the video, the nurse took the time to actually, you know, do an in-depth evaluation. And what came out of it was the patient just didn't understand her medication list, wasn't taking her medications properly, and was suffering because no one really took the time to MacGyver it, to figure it out, to actually do those critical, you know, problem-solving skills in order to do something that was so simple. Okay, Mrs. Jones, here's the story. You know, this is the medication that you're not currently taking and which might help you. And here, you know, and it took a full 12 minutes or so to get that done. But 12 minutes in the life of in a busy cancer clinic sounds like a really short amount of time, but it's not. It's like a lifetime. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that as well.
So speaking about that example, we also had another example that we wrote about where, and this has to do with time, where the patient called in, got a nurse, was quickly dismissed and told to what they can do to self-manage the problem. The patient phones another day later, same problem. The nurse quickly just gives them instructions and gets them back off the phone and tells them to stop, to do something that they can manage on their own. So then they got the third nurse on the third call. And that nurse actually took the time to use the CoSTARS guidance document on the symptom. And suddenly, once they actually did the proper assessment and got down into a few other questions beyond just focused on the symptom, they actually realized there was another problem going on that was actually underlying this symptom. And with that, they could actually take action and solve the problem with this patient. And so we actually wrote that up as a paper to demonstrate that if you think about time just in that 13 minutes or 12 minutes you just said, that might seem long, but when you don't actually manage and help people manage things well, they'll keep coming back or keep showing up at the emergency or whatever until they get the problem fixed. And so I think what we need to be thinking more about is what's the right amount of time for the right way of managing a different problem?
Well said. When you don't do the work the right way, you don't build your foundation, the foundation is going to crumble and you're going to end up with a bigger mess than had you taken the time to begin with, I think, right? Claire?
And I think at the end of the day, it's about quality of life, isn't it? And for patients that are suffering, you're taking away valuable time, that time they can never recover that time. And so I tend to look at it through a patient's lens. And, you know, that's, you're not alleviating suffering and you're depriving them of quality time that they'll never get back.
Thank you very much for that, Claire. Dawn, I wanted to give you another acknowledgement and thank you for that training video, in the sense that the nurse was trained to be very empathetic to the patient. So it was a no judgment zone. I mean, when the patient wasn't doing what they were told, and probably wasn't told very well, or probably told very quickly. And it was an elderly patient, if I recall. And when we talk about part two, we're going to talk about frail patients and chronically ill patients who are particularly vulnerable to this low quality care, I guess you can say. But the nurse really was listened, did not make the patient feel like she was a dummy, that she didn't take her medicines properly, really was again, as I said, nurses are healers, advocates, but probably just as important, teachers. And being able to teach a patient in that no judgment, safe environment came out to me as a watcher of this. Would you guys comment on that observation?
I also agree that there is really good interaction between the nurse and the patient around empathy. One of the things that I teach new nurses is that for the nurse, they see this over and over and over again. But for that patient there sitting in front of them, this is the first time. And that we need to stop thinking about blocking them into a group that said, oh no, they're not adhering. I hate the word adherence because it's implying that the patient taking the medications knew exactly what they need to be doing. And it's taking the responsibility off of me as a nurse to speak to the patient and actually help them understand how the medication works, how it's to be taken. And so I think we need to have that empathy and that think about it as always the first time, the first interaction I have with a patient.
I agree. Yes, Claire.
And Dawn, that's just so refreshing, so lovely to hear you saying that as well, because it's so true. I think, you know, healthcare professionals can get a bit jaded and, here we go, nausea again or fatigue again. And for somebody who is in that acute phase or just has been ill for many, many months or years, it's... For them, it still feels like the first time. The other thing that I would say about time is really finding out what's important to the patient. And so I can give you a story that kind of fits with my own belief system and my adherence to my medication regime. So I have a belief system where it's okay for me to suffer pain, not extreme pain, but I will tolerate pain just as sort of part of my journey. And that is unacceptable for many, many of the nurses and my doctor who felt I shouldn't be suffering at all with pain. Other symptoms it was okay to suffer with, but with pain, I should have been pain-free. But I was okay to tolerate, you know, like a 6 on the pain scale, for instance. And that was okay for me to do that as part of my own belief system, my own spiritual journey. And so it's really listening and taking the time to hear what's important to your patient, and are there things that they, you know, symptoms that they don't necessarily need to have controlled 100%. So, you know, was fatigue, it was more important for me to manage fatigue than it was for pain. And so I think it really is taking the time to understand that your patient that's in front of you.
Thank you. Thank you, Claire. Dawn, as we're looking at this ideal model, which is absolutely the way we need to do things, there's no question in my mind. Let's talk about some obstacles for the caregivers to obtain or to achieve this model for our patients who are deserving for this perfect model, or, you know, nothing's perfect, but for a better model. Burnout, people, nurses, doctors being overstretched, organizations, big medical centers in the economic crunches where everyone is understaffed, you know, and again, going back to that word, that's a kind of a cliche, but, you know, caregiver burnout. I mean, we do get burnt out. And, you know, when Dawn mentioned walking into a room and seeing somebody with nausea, you know, it's like almost as if you get nauseous if you have to hear another person have nausea, and you're thinking, wow, what a horrible person I am. But you're not, you're just burnt out, or you're just tired, or you just have 15 people waiting for you. And, you know, I was hoping you guys could kind of, you know, address that. Now, this subject will be a new, its own module, right? Caregiver burnout, but just as it relates to trying to implement the CoSTARS into a clinic.
So one of the key things I think with CoSTARS is it's actually to support nurses on the telephone and validate that this is a really important role for nurses, because in most centers, that responding to the calls happens on top of running the clinic and everything else that they're doing, giving chemotherapy. And so one of the things that CoSTARS has also done is really brought to the attention that this is an important role for nurses. It's an important opportunity to be able to be better supporting patients at a distance or at home most of the time, trying to recover after chemotherapy or radiation treatments. And so I think that's also a really important element of CoSTARS to try and validate that we need nurses given time to be able to respond to calls and not doing it off the back of their desks or as they're walking down the hallway, getting from point A to point B.
Do you often, you know, help nurses when they do feel overwhelmed, you know, advocate for them, you know, to say, hey, listen, there's only so much this amount of nurses can do or whatever to achieve what you want us to achieve?
Well, absolutely. And especially around staffing for this role. So different cancer centers have different models. Some have it that you always phone the same nurse all the time, and other centers have a hotline that you'll get the nurse that's managing that line, but you can still get the support you need or connected into the nurse physician team that you're used to working, provide this service in a way that we can better support patients from a distance without adding another burden on the healthcare system or healthcare professionals that have to be responding to these calls.
And you and I are starting to think alike, because the next bullet point I had to ask you about was actual telemedicine. This, as you mentioned, the CoSTARS is made also for not face-to-face interaction, but also for televisits, which I think everyone around the world is getting pretty good at with, you know, coronavirus. If coronavirus hasn't done anything, it has certainly taught us, you know, how to be better interacting with patients not face-to-face. And I was hoping you sort of addressed it, but maybe address it a little deeper.
So absolutely, CoSTARS can be used either face-to-face or by the telephone. It was actually originally created for use on the telephone to try and ensure that we're using nurses to their optimal practice to be able to better support patients. So CoStars was originally developed for use on the phone, but also we wanted to have consistency with when patients are given guidance on the telephone, they receive the same guidance in person in the clinic. And so, in fact, CoStars has been implemented in face-to-face as well as at a distance. And in doing so, it's really around trying to help nurses work to optimum scope of practice, because many times we've seen in our tape recordings that it's a quick, oh, you've got this problem, I'll tell the doctor and let him respond to you.
Yeah, that's a, you know, that is, I've said this, I think to you, Dawn, but I've said it on the podcast a million times. We really need to empower nurses to do more because we have to give them the confidence. We have to give them the training in order to do more because, you know, the doctors are doing a terrible job because they don't have the time or the inclination to do the things that you guys can do. You can do it much better than we can. And I'm not going out on a limb by saying that. Claire, I wanted to ask you before we actually, I wanted to go to my computer and actually go to the website, and we're going to get to how everyone is going to, you know, have access to the website, how to get it, how to get this information. But before we go and actually, you know, evaluate the website, look at it, and then Dawn will get us to go through it. Tell us about how you began in the CoStars program with Dawn.
Yeah, it was quite a convoluted journey, I have to say. So in my professional life, I'm a senior healthcare administrator and in a home and community care environment. And Dawn approached my organization about the home care nurses who treat cancer patients in the community. About whether we could implement CoStars in for home care nurses looking after cancer patients. And so I was really, really very enthusiastic, in part because it was a very different approach to research that Dawn was taking. She was actually bringing in stakeholders who were going to use the research, use the tools to look at how we could best implement. So that was my first introduction, and I was so enamored with that research approach that I spoke to Dawn about doing my PhD. And, you know, so I then started my PhD and worked for Dawn as a research assistant looking at implementation of CoStars with radiation therapists. And during that time, I became so acutely ill. I just got sicker and sicker and sicker. And it was about a 6 month period or so that I just ended up in the hospital for about 12 days or so, very acutely ill, and was diagnosed with cancer at that point, and very, very unwell. And so I took a step back from my PhD, obviously, to focus on my cancer treatment. And I think I was halfway through it and just feeling quite despondent and really, really not feeling very useful, or but also not having the energy to do much. And so I approached Dawn and said, you know, is there anything that I can help with? And so then I started working on another project that Dawn was running, but really looking at the quality of the interaction between the nurses and the patients who were calling into the telephone line. And I think it was the first interview that I was analyzing. I realized I wasn't analyzing it as a nurse. I wasn't analyzing it from an academic perspective, but I was experiencing the very same symptoms that the patient was talking about as though I were the patient. And so I think it added a different layer of analysis there. And actually it flipped my research topic a number of months later to looking at patient engagement in research as a partner in research rather than as a participant.
I am very much. Everyone, that's a little bit of a taste, a teaser for the second part of the podcast, and that's going to be wonderful. But I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge Claire, what a very courageous story that was, and how fortunate we are that we had you share that with us. There are many people who listen to that, to this podcast, where you know, that's a very big part of their life. Their life is going in a certain way, and there's a famous expression, God, man makes plans, humans make plans, and God laughs, right? So your life is going in a certain trajectory, and then all of a sudden God says, well, you know what, Claire, you're not going this way, you're going to go down this road. And we never know what it's for, what the purpose is, but I can tell the listeners that they better listen to part two, because the direction that Claire's research went is nothing short of groundbreaking and very, what would you say, trailblazing. So we will get to that in more detail. Dawn, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
So I found it extremely helpful having Claire do this analysis. And in the beginning, I was trying to meet her need, that she wanted something to do, that she was contributing to the project. But then I realized how rich it was and how important it was to have her perspective on analyzing these interactions between nurses and patients. And I also had an oncology nurse also analyzing them. And then we would come to agreement around how well was the interaction, around how well did they assess the symptom, how well did they talk about the medications. This ended up turning out to, I think, over 100 tape recordings that Claire was involved in analyzing while she was undergoing chemotherapy at the same time. And it was like, wow. Most of the time, I would never approach someone on chemotherapy to ask them if they would do something to this extent as being as part of the research team. And it just sort of happened. And I realized that this is something we should be thinking about, as how can we appropriately, it worked out well in this situation. I don't know, it was coincidental. So I don't know how I would plan it directly the next time. But I would definitely think about, how do I get the patient's voice into how we're interpreting the research findings?
Yeah, well, very well said. And again, we were talking about modules and naming modules. Claire, this very, very well could be in our heroes module, because you really are a hero. Thank you, Tom. Now, getting to the part where we discussed offline, now is where the meat is. So, Dawn, I'm a patient. And I listen to this Croc podcast and I'm like, wow, I'm really having these symptoms. I'm having these troubles. I want to get to this website. And I promise that between Rod, Angel, and myself, we will make sure that our website has really good access for people who want to refer to our website to get onto the CoStars. But just, we can't say it too many times, right? Repetition is really important. Tell us, so I'm going to go right to my little computer and tell us about the website, tell us, you know, how it sort of is constructed, and help me as a patient. Let's use, how about anxiety? I'm an anxious person. Let's use the anxiety algorithm. How's that sound?
That sounds good, but I'm going to switch you over to breathlessness. I'll tell you why later.
Breathlessness, that's even better. I'm breathless as well.
So if you go over to Google, because Google's our friend, and you type in CoStars, KT Canada, then it should be pretty close to the top of the hit list around websites that you can go to. It's at the Ottawa Hospital Research Institute that we have this website, which is our Ottawa Hospital website. And then you can actually see the link to CoStars in English or in French, and you can also see the link to training. And so if you click on the CoStars English, then you can actually get access to all of the different symptoms. I think we're up to about 17 different symptoms, and you can go to B for breathlessness.
Let's stop 1 second.
I just want to just remark to the listeners, that first page, that welcome page is awesome because there's other things there that you can get. So that's where I got the online tutorial and the entire, although the online tutorial, I think you need to have a password too, if I'm not mistaken.
But it's all free of charge. You just create your own name and password.
Yep, and they do have, you do have the video of the demonstration that we mentioned right on the welcoming page.
So if you click on the CoStars link,
yep,
and you go to the breathlessness. So the reason why I want to bring this up is one of my students, Freya, she really wanted to do something around the heart toxicity that patients experience and the link over to cardiology. Okay. And that we were setting up a cardiology oncology clinic at the time in Ottawa. And so she wanted to figure out what was the symptom that crosses both into cardiology and into oncology. So we picked breathlessness. And Freya went and identified the guidelines for cardiology so that we could make sure that we integrate the two, the evidence from both cardiology and cancer treatment into this one. So you can see little hearts for the symptoms that are more linked to the cardiology side or the heart side. And then the rest are like the usual CoStars type questions. So we specifically did this one more for cancer survivors or people once they're done treatment, where if they had chemotherapy that does have some toxicity to the heart, that if they started to have symptoms of breathlessness over time, that they could look to see, like, how bad is it? And at what point do I call in? At what point do I go into the emergency, for example? And so that is the one example where we actually were looking at trying to figure out how we would adapt it for cancer survivors in the community that could then use it on their own. And so that's our one template example. We didn't end up moving forward because it was actually quite a bit of work just to get it agreement from everybody that this would be a really good symptom guide that people could go through if it was cardiotoxicity or if it was just breathlessness from a chemotherapy related side effect.
And it's very comprehensive, Dawn. It's wonderful. So let's go through it. Let's kind of go through it a little bit for a patient who has breathlessness and goes to the CoStars. You know, I'm noticing here that there's an assessment of the severity of the breathlessness, which there's 13 guidelines that are supporting the evidence. The second part, triage for symptom management based on the highest severity. And the third thing is to review the medications, you know, for the shortness of breath, including the prescribed medications and herbal supplements. And four is to review three or more self-care strategies. And five is a summary. So would you say that that's accurate?
Yes, that was a good description of the five sections.
Excellent. So obviously, we start, we were talking about foundations before. We begin with part one, right? We go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So in part one, just looking at this now, basically what you guys out there are wonderful survivors is, you know, are you worried about your shortness of breath? And then is the question. And then we have symptoms from 1 to 3, 4 to 6, and 7 to 10 with being no or some, yes and very, and of course 7 to 10 being obviously, yes. Do you pause while talking every 5 to 15 seconds? Is your breath noisy, rattling, or congested, et cetera? Do you wake suddenly short of breath? You ask about fever, chest pain. And again, there's that little heart, which indicates a cardiac, a potential cardiac question. Gained or lost weight, indicating perhaps cardiac failure, I'm thinking you guys are thinking about, and that type of thing. And that would be the first part. So you would fill that out, and I guess you would get a score, and you'd have one green would be for mild, two yellow would be for moderate, red being severe. So almost like a stop sign, right? Or a light, you know, a traffic light. And then the triage is, you know, again, looking to review and secure your different review, self-care, review your medications, that type of thing. And then if you go to three, it's refer to medical attention immediately, right? You want to get your patients to realize that they shouldn't be fooling around. They need to seek medical attention. And then when they're reviewing the medications,
Tom, can I just go back to the first part?
Absolutely. I would really like you to do that. Yes.
So you can see that we have ticks that say it's if it's mild or moderate or severe.
Yes.
But this has really been designed for nurses that need to then apply their own judgment. And so even if you have one in the severe, you may still decide that they're only moderate based on your overall assessment. And so when I talk about nursing, we often talk about the science and the art of nursing. So the science is this document that's communicating what does the evidence show. And then the art is how it's used in practice. And so you really need to be thinking about how the two can be used together. And I think this also created a bit of a challenge when we wanted to adapt it for the public to use or cancer survivors to use, is that they don't have the years of experience of how to manage breathlessness that they can build upon to then make a good judgment around, is it mild, moderate, or severe overall after you do this assessment. And so we did leave this as a tool for nurses, but I think if we were to look at constipation or anxiety, some of the other ones, depression, I think many of those assessments and the self-care strategies are things that all of us could actually be checking in on, even though it's really supposed to be for cancer-specific symptom management.
No, I think it's wonderful. And thank you for correcting me, because I do agree. So again, for our listeners, the CoSTARS assessments, you know, symptom assessments and things are for the patients for sure, but also as a very useful tool for our caretakers, for our caregivers. I always get that wrong. So for our caregivers and, you know, a patient like Claire, you've helped maybe design or be part of this process. And now on the other side of the ball as a patient, you know, how have you utilized, you know, some of these CoSTARS?
Well, I think it really has made me think about, and I think building on Dawn's point about the science and the art, so the science of practice, the art of practice, because sometimes we can go through things very systematically, but if we're not hearing what the patient is saying, then we may just be, and I think of an example in one of the interviews that I listened to. I think of the nurse who did a perfect assessment. She ticked every single box, but what she didn't hear was the patient's fatigue and nausea, and she had lost the patient halfway through the interaction. And so I think it is about, you know, asking the questions, but making sure that you're hearing the answers, that you're empowering your patient to kind of choose the path that they will act on. So if I don't want to take my antiemetic and I would rather just sort of not eat or just have something, you know, crackers or water that day, then, you know, you have to listen to what works for your patient.
Thank you. Dawn, how would you say the program is working out in Ottawa and beyond?
So the CoSTARS are used in many cancer programs across Canada. They're also used, they were used in a study in Sacramento, California. In Washington State, there's some work going on around implementing them in cancer care. So there is different projects in the US. They're also being used actually in Hong Kong right now to actually add traditional Chinese medicine into them based on an evidence review and then translated into Chinese, and being tested right now in clinical care environments. And so they are being used in various different ways across Canada, some a bit in the US and then in Hong Kong.
I'm a big fan of Dr. Atwal Gawande and read all his books, obviously, and he made great impact with his checklist manifesto and things. I think that this is to that level, Dawn. I think that I would really want to see, this integrated in all cancer work, in all cancer care, where survivors are being managed, because they deserve it. They deserve this level of consideration. And I really am very hopeful that your work will translate even more broadly and more ubiquitously into all the cancer centers. Yes, Claire.
And I just like to add, I think what the CoSTARS adds as well is kind of more of a systematic approach. Because often I think as, nurses or doctors, we think that we're kind of really delving into an issue, and we think that we're using the most current evidence. And so I think what CoSTARS really does is help guide. So even for, say, newer nurses, it helps guide that interaction. It's based in evidence, and it really does give that sort of systematic approach. And we really saw the difference between the nurses who used the CoSTARS in their practice and those who didn't.
I couldn't agree more. As a matter of fact, as I said, it legitimizes a systematic approach. As I mentioned, Dr. Gwandi, it's not that every organization in the world has his checklist. But the necessity of a checklist to prevent a catastrophic outcome. And I think even more importantly, when I first started practice, we learned a certain way, we knew the data, but it wasn't like we were practicing with data. Now we're practicing with what's called, high level of confidence of data, intermediate level of confidence of data, and low, confidence of data. And I think what Dawn's work and your work is doing is you're basically giving the same face, but the symptom management. And I think that it is genius. I think it's necessary. And I think, as I used the word ubiquitous already, but I'm going to use it again, it should be ubiquitous. It should be everywhere. Because getting back to me, the guy in the clinic, rushing from room to room, managing nausea, I think I'm managing it well. But if you were to look at me and judge me on a video, I'm probably going to get a C, and that's only because you know me and like me, probably would deserve an F. But, and this is important. This is really good. Before we leave this part one, I wanted to ask you two if you had anything else you wanted to share with our listeners that you want them to know about CoSTARS symptom management. We're going to make sure we get them the information on how to find it. Don't worry about that. But just what you want them to know before we go on to part two.
So I just wanted to reflect on the comment I got from a medical oncologist that specialized in colon cancer. And he said that he keeps a copy on his desk because when he is in the middle of a call, his mind is going in a million directions all day. And suddenly he has to focus on diarrhea and figuring out what's going on. And he said he finds it really helpful as a nice summary of the prompts that he needs to just get focused on in that call at that time. And so I think they're useful to everybody that could be benefiting from CoSTARS.
Claire, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I think I'd just like to reiterate a point I made earlier, and that is symptom management. Really good symptom management makes all the difference in a patient's life. As I said before, this is time that patients will never get back again. And reflecting back on my own journey, I think those practitioners that do symptom management well, they're like angels.
Nurses are angels. I hope you know that. Now, you would think that I always have the last word on my own podcast, but I don't. My co-host, Angel Santana, I always give him the mic at the end because he's able to take a layperson's perspective. He's been listening. He's been absorbing. He writes his notes, and he always has something very profound to say.
I find it very interesting to have a point of view from the patient, and it's nice to be able to take a step back and listen to what you've gone through, and of course, where you've adapted and where you've overcome. I think that I would also like to piggyback off of Dr. E when
He said, you are a hero. I found a different word for you. I kept thinking of the word courage, because I find that your courage strengthened me to understand and be more aware of the type of environment and the type of things that patients go through. So for that, I say, I'm truly, truly blessed to be in your presence, but more empowered to believe that the card that was dealt to you, you could have folded your hand. You made it into a better, I've never been a good poker player, but you turned it into a royal flush.
Right, exactly. She took a pair of twos and she drew a royal flush. That's
so for that, yes. Awesome job.
Yeah. Aren't they unbelievable?
Amazing.
May I sign off?
Oh, without a doubt. This is an amazing show. I can't wait for part two.
Oh my gosh. Croc Nation, what a true, true gem we've given you today. Part one of patient empowerment, our first patient empowerment module, symptom management, the co-star program, Dr. Dawn Stacey, soon to be Dr. Claire Ludwig. I end our podcast always, every single week, with our gratitude shout outs. Angel Santana, have faith, let it begin. Thank you, Angel.
You're welcome.
Rod Freeman, Small Biz Up. Anybody who has a small business and wants to get out there and grow your business through social media, Rod would be your guy. Michael John Benzea, Charlotte Larson from Hollywood, thank you for your support of this wonderful podcast for our wonderful survivors. And as always, Angel, I end every podcast exactly the same. To my Croc Nation, we wish you all, on behalf of the four of us, the three of us, the four of us, we wish you a long, healthy, happy, and cancer-free life. God bless you. God keep you. Peace.